Welcome to the Mite Bomb Beekeeping Podcast. This is Bruce Rodriguez. Today, what seems like it's going to be a second installment of the Really series on the chopping block, I guess you'd call it, is a paper called Your Bees Don't Have to Die. It's an article written by Megan Milbrath from Michigan State University. The subtitle is How can we become treatment free without killing our colonies? Now, I could go on forever just on the title alone, but it's kind of a long article, so. But let's just address the title, the subtitle, I guess you'd call it. I don't kill my colonies. So right off the bat, I have an issue with the title of the thing. It's funny. Some bees are unfit. They do die. Just as anybody who has bees and whoever treats them every step of the way, they still have colonies that die. But to imply that people who are selecting for survival are killing colonies, it's just right away disingenuous. But let's just move on. I became aware of this article from listening to another podcast, Beekeeping at Five Apple Farms, one that I listen to a lot. And the host read this article with a much more pleasing voice than I have, but I'm going to try to read it and address it. It's almost every sentence I'm going to cut in and just give my side. To me, Dr. Megan Milbrath is kind of like the other PhD doctors on the speaking circuit. They have PhDs and things, they're doctors, whatever. They can't pull my kidney out of my ear. If I'm calling someone a doctor, that's usually why I'm calling them that. From what I know, I'd be happy if anyone wants to correct me. Of the PhD people called doctor all the time, what they got their PhDs in isn't exactly related to evolutionary biology most times. I do know one that has that, but none that I regularly see on the circuit talking. It gives them a kind of credibility, immediate credibility, that I think is a little overemphasized. But let's get the heck past that and just get into this thing. So the article, How We Can Become Treatment Free Without Killing Bees, Without Killing Our Colonies. It begins. Keeping bees with my dad was fun when I was a kid in northern Wisconsin. It was a golden era of beekeeping. It was easy. The bees all lived, and I hadn't even heard about the varroa mite. Well, this is me getting right in there to say the bees all lived in the golden era of beekeeping. I think this is some revisionist history that I hear a lot about how before mites came along, everybody just put bees in their yard, didn't do anything, took honey off, and they all lived. And I'm here to tell you, after researching a little bit, that's complete bullshit over and over again. You can go back to, I'm going to mention the name Scott McPherson, who I listened to his YouTube channel. He read some of the hive colony survival stats from, I forget the name of the very well-known beekeeper from the early 1900s. And he had years where 75, 80, 90% of his colonies died over winter from things well before mites were around. If you're going to tell me that from that point that he was just some kind of fluke in history, you'd be wrong. I've also, if you read Brother Abbey, his books, he also talks about taking heavy losses over winters. This idea that you could have so many colonies and they all lived every year, it's totally untrue. So here again, to say the bees all lived, I'm calling, I don't think so. That's what I'll call it, okay? To go on, 15 years later, while in school in Michigan, beekeeping didn't seem as fun or as easy. Every conversation that I had with beekeepers centered on figuring out why their bees were dying. Beekeepers were sick of losing bees and sick of treating for Varroa. So, this is me again. They're treating for Varroa and their bees are dying. I mean, we all know that treating is not saving your bees. But let's go on. They wanted treatment-free, strong northern bees. So here's the first misuse of the adjective treatment-free. No one has treatment-free bees. Even me, I'm a treatment-free beekeeper. Okay, the bees don't apply treatments to themselves. It's silly to use the term, oh, I want a treatment-free queen, I want treatment-free bees. No, you want the resulting stock of a treatment-free beekeeper. You want survivor bees or whatever you want to call them that are a result of treatment-free beekeeping by a treatment-free beekeeper. There's not treatment-free bees. If I buy a nuke or a package, put it in my yard, and I just don't treat it, that doesn't make me a treatment-free beekeeper. That doesn't make those bees treatment-free bees. Those are bees that depend on treatments not being treated, so you're basically just letting them die. That's not what I do. I never suggest that to anybody. So that's the first time. But let's try to go on. I'm not even through the first half paragraph. So I started rearing queens with the goal of raising these strong northern bees that could thrive without treatment. Okay, then here's me. That's ambitious. You're going to use some bees that are dependent on treatments to raise these quote strong northern bees that can survive without treatments. Okay, let's see what happens. I had been collecting swarms for years. Good. Getting the best queens from local beekeepers and trying out fancy stock like Canadian Buckfast and Minnesota Hygienic. Basically, all treated bees. I had been reading up online and I wanted to find the best bees that could survive Varroa. At that time, there was a lot of support for the live and let die method, where you let your bees go with no care, and whichever ones survive naturally, in quotes, are your new better stock. Is that really what it is? Is it where you just let your bees go with no care? Maybe without treatments, okay? But I don't just let my bees go. What do you define as care? I mean, I inspect, I make sure there's their queen right. I'll feed if I have to. But to keep saying these things, let your bees go with no care, and whichever ones survive naturally are your new better stock. Whatever, let's go on. I had some colonies that I thought had a lot of potential, so I let them go, hoping to find out which hives held my new hardy treatment-free bees. Again, using the term treatment-free and applying it to bees. She's not starting with the result of selection. She's starting with bees that have had zero selection. But let's try to go on. The outcome that spring was horrible and really made me rethink why and how I want to keep bees. In this article, I am going to explain why the live and let die system doesn't work for my beekeeping, and probably yours too, and to give you a new method that can help you find your best bees while keeping you happy and your bees healthy. Okay, so that was just the introduction. Let's begin the article. Issues with the live and let die treatment-free beekeeping. Number one, my animals suffered. Two, I put the bees around me at risk. Three, it was really expensive. Really? Four, it made me miss good genetics. It didn't work for getting better bees. Well, number one, your animals suffered. I would say I don't really know that they suffered. That this is called this is a prey and predator or parasite relationship. Maybe we see it as suffering, but looking into the future, you need to know which ones are going to survive what you call suffering, and many do. I know this because I have done this sad thing that this article talks about, and bees have survived and lived. Two, she puts the bees around her at risk. Well, that's up for debate, because my bees here don't even put the bees right next to them at risk, so I don't know how that works. Three, it was really expensive. Well, that's a beekeeper's choice. That's to buy bees, you know, take it how you want to take it. If you're a small hobbyist, to buy bees is lazy. I mean, I don't get as mad as you want. I don't care. I don't really try that hard to get my bees. And I average about 50 swarms a year. And I turn down a lot of bees. I give all my secrets how to do that. It's not even really secrets. And four, it made me miss good genetics. It didn't work for getting better bees. Well, contrarily, the way you're going to miss good genetics is by arbitrarily selecting your bees by mite counts, not actually knowing if they can survive said mite counts. Let's go on. Number one, suffering bees. My treatment-free colonies looked great all year. But when I opened the hives for a late final inspection before winter, I felt sick to my stomach by what I saw. Okay, to feel sick to your stomach, you know, this isn't really an opinion. There is a healthy amount of dispassion, a word I just learned the other day. Dispassion that is necessary if you're going to take on a selection program, the one that's so easy. It's either they live or they die. If you're a scientist who studies this kind of thing, you can't get your emotions all tied up in everything all the time. So feeling sick to the stomach, I would expect that from a Karen type, two hive in the backyard, doesn't know anything about any bugs in their whole life, and then get sad about her babies dying. I understand that from a very small hobbyist perspective. I mean, I don't do that, but I wouldn't expect this from a scientist or someone who's being looked to as an authority on this subject. I'm not feeling sick to my stomach. But let's go on. Spotty brood, melted larvae, a small demoralized looking bees, colonies deep in the throes of parasitic mite syndrome. My thriving, booming colonies had been reduced to small clusters, working desperately to raise the few larvae that were left after the viruses had devastated most of the young. Full supers of honey for winter look ridiculous now, sitting optimistically on top of colonies that were mere shells of what had gathered that nectar all summer. It didn't take a diagnostic expert to know that my bees were profoundly sick and didn't have a chance that winter. Okay. My husband and I have raised all sorts of animals on our little farm. Pigs, chickens, rabbits, cattle, sheep, goats, ducks, dogs, horses, you name it. We have the same philosophy for all of our animals. If it is under our care, we will keep it in good health. Every animal gets good food, clean bedding, and the attention they need. Okay, I don't have any problem with that. Those are all livestock. I have chickens, rabbit, dogs, you name it. I have that, and I can agree with that. I'm not selecting some type of hawk-resistant chicken or flea-resistant dog. And if I had a say congenitally defective rabbit, I could easily not breed that rabbit. You know, that's the I don't know why I need to point this out to the people on the circuit with the authorities here. We know there's a difference between an insect that open mates for miles around and your chickens and your horse that you can keep fenced in that you don't let run into your neighbor's pasture with their horses. Okay, there's a difference. But here's the good part. We would never let a sick ewe suffer and slowly die, or let a pig walk around with a devastating injury. Neither would I. I don't know what, I don't have a ewe or a pig, but an injury is different from a congenital defect. I mean, I'm not even a doctor. Anyone should know that. Treat your sheep, treat your pig, get it better, or eat it, whatever you have to do to it. It's not a good comparison, people. Please stop doing this. I care for my bees, and it didn't make any sense to me to let them suffer and die slowly. This is especially true now that I know it is unnecessary, as you will read at the end of this article. Okay. We know that colonies with high levels of varroa have all sorts of viruses, poor nutrition, and very little chance at living through any sort of winter. Let alone having the energy to raise brood in the spring. Do we really know that? As you'll see if I ever get to the end of this thing, this author has no way of knowing that because she literally quit after one season. I've been doing this for quite a few seasons, and I can tell you that that colonies that I'm sure have very high levels of varroa can make it through winter and do have the energy to raise brood in the spring. But let's go on. Part of the problem is that most beekeepers who lose bees to varroa-associated viruses never see it happen. They wrap up their big booming colony in the fall and then clean up the dead out in the spring. It literally happens inside a dark box, and beekeepers can skip the sad suffering part. Again, that's dispassion. It's something if you don't have it, you're just never going to have it, I guess. Here we go. If you are thinking about not managing varroa mites in your colonies as a way to keep bees, oh my God, here it goes. I urge you to open the colony while they are in the dying process. Look those suffering girls right in their compound eyes. I gotta say that again. Look those suffering girls right in their compound eyes and reflect on how you want to provide for animals under your care. It just doesn't feel right to call yourself a beekeeper while letting your bees die a slow, preventable death. Well, for me, once a scientist refers to bees as girls, and you're looking at them right in their compound eyes, like some kind of sad Disney movie, all credibility is out the window. It's gone. So whether someone doesn't feel right calling me a beekeeper, okay, that's fine with that. Let's just as you can tell, this thing really annoys me, but hey, no one else is doing this. There's only one other treatment-free beekeeping podcast, the Treatment Free Beekeeping Podcast, that actually stands up and represents treatment free beekeepers correctly. Or in my case, just responds to the silly stuff that's disseminated by treaters and kind of not really treatment free beekeepers. The other ones kind of wave as they drive by. They're not treatment free. There's no other treatment free podcast, but let's go on. Number two, save the bees? Like a lot of beekeepers, I take pride in knowing that I am providing pollination services to gardens and plants, and I like to think that I'm doing some good by keeping bees. When I had sick colonies, however, I realized that my beekeeping was probably doing more harm than good to my environment. I was putting the pollinators around me at risk. Well, here, first let me tell you how you were doing that. You were using bees that depend on every life-saving tactic, and that's what you're propagating for, I guess, years. And you're allowing those bees to weaken the feral population around you. But let's see why this author thinks they did more harm than good to their environment. When a colony is sick, like my bees with mites and viruses, it becomes weak. Weak colonies get robbed by bees from all the nearby colonies. We also know that bees are more likely to leave or abscond from a dying colony. Ever had a colony up and leave in the fall? Think about if you had rural populations under control in these hives. Through drifting and robbing, sick colonies can act as a disease reservoir, with your bees spreading disease throughout your area. Honeybee colonies are everywhere nowadays, and it's impossible to know every hive hidden in a backyard or wild colony that was living happily in a tree until you came along and threatened them with your sick bees. Now, that sentence needs a little bit of attention there. The author seems to think that bees that were living happily in a tree until you came along, somehow those bees are superior to someone who's only using mostly feral bees and letting them live almost exactly the way they would in a tree. How in the world do bees, and according to most of this article, bees can't happily live in a tree because they need to have this special non-treatment-free beekeeping practice inflicted on them. So it's very contradictory to say, here's someone who actually does beekeeping without treatments, does selection, doesn't prop up weak genetics and weak colonies, which is exactly what happens in the woods and in these hollow trees. But then to simultaneously say that I'm threatening those same exact bees. I mean, whatever, let's go. Even worse, it isn't just honeybees that are at risk. We even see deformed wing virus spreading to bumblebees and some of our native bees. Okay. Now that would be a good argument if I knew that I was somehow threatening native bees with different viruses. Okay, I wouldn't like that. But I don't see how treated bees or non-treated bees are going to affect them any differently. It's still bees. It's still a non-native bee in a place where it was introduced. So I'll take that. Our native pollinators are already facing huge problems with habitat loss and pesticide exposure. And I don't want to be the one with the Save the Bees bumper sticker that is quietly infecting my native pollinator population with new diseases. Okay, I don't know if we're actually doing that, but hey, that'd be something to read about, I guess. I'd really like my effect on the environment around me to be positive. I don't want my role to be the person that maintains disease and infection and makes it worse for nearby bees and beekeepers by perpetuating an epidemic in my area. Okay. So basically, mite bombs, that's what she's talking about. And we already know that mite bombs are just a fairly recent excuse for treatments not working, because we didn't hear about them for the first 25 years mites were here, or the first actually 30 years that mites have been here. Now all of a sudden it's mite bombs everywhere. Number three is called a bass boat would have been cheaper. And here we get to the real reason. Even if you have an icy, shriveled little prune heart, oh God, that hurt. And it doesn't bother you to let your bees die or to put the bees around you at risk. It shouldn't take long to figure out that the economics just don't work. Icy, shriveled little prune heart. Seriously? Really? Anybody that knows me would tell you that my heart may be shriveled a little bit, but it's not icy and it's not a prune. But, and it doesn't bother you to let your bees die or to put the bees around you at risk. Okay. It does bother me to see anything die. Dying is not a fun thing. But in this case, I know what my goal is. I know what the problem is, and I know what the solution is. So there's no way to select without death. So it's part of the process. It's not, as Solomon Parker would say, it's not a glitch in the system. It's part of it. Of the 24 treatment-free colonies I put into winter, about six made it through alive. So here she goes again. Of the 24 treatment-free colonies I put into winter, about six made it through alive. Firstly, you didn't put 24 treatment-free colonies through winter. You put 24 colonies that depend on treatments through a winter without the treatments that they depend on. And then she says, about six made it through alive. Well, we're not dealing with big numbers here. Is it six? Is it seven? It's not about six. Which one is it? So 24, started with 24, has six left. Okay, 75% culling rate. I would have expected much worse considering what she started with. But that looks good. For starting with what you started with. This result isn't unusual for treatment-free beekeeping, and many people I talk to lose 50 to 100% of their colonies every year. Others using the live and let die method record losses of 95%. And I addressed this on a internet post. To have a 95% loss mathematically requires you to have at least 20 colonies and lose 19 of those 20. If the previous mention of basically mite bombing and spreading disease and all that crap is true, how are you going to have one survivor on a yard of 19 dead colonies? It doesn't make sense to me. It pretty much disproves the theory almost instantly. And no, it's not happening. She goes, if I had kept my losses to my normal 15%, well, I thought they'd all live. They should all live. If the way you were treating them before, they should have all lived. I would have come out a winner with about 20 hives of the original 24. Actually, 20 colonies, not 20 hives. You still have the hive equipment, but I usually split my colonies in the spring and make an average of 75 pounds of honey from each split. From my six hives, that would have been 900 pounds of honey. From 20 overwintered hives, I could expect 3,000 pounds. My little experiment literally cost me 1 ton of honey. So there you have it. To me, that's the main driver of all this baloney. It's money. It's honey money. There's no way around it. I don't even care about honey. I still have too much to deal. I hate dealing with it, but I still have plenty. And I'm in no way in shortage of honey. Let's say I didn't care about the honey, but was interested in bees. Oh, okay, let's say that. I can usually make 3 nucs from every overwintered hive. Yeah, me too. Now I have just over 40 nucs that I could have made available to beekeepers in my area looking for local bees. In other words, sell. At a price of $150 per nuc. I could have made a lot of money that I could have donated to honeybee research at MSU with a link. Or have gotten a new fishing boat. We try to practice sustainable farming, and there is nothing sustainable about losses that high. So I just want to say again, there you have it. It's about money. The real bad regret about this is about money and selling nukes. I don't pay for any bees, so I don't know what it's like to lose money in the bees. But let's go to number 4. What kind of bees am I left with? The reason we let our bees die without treatment is to find bees that can survive varroa. We think that it will work like textbook natural selection. We put in a pressure, the weak die, and the strong survive. Let me just stop there and say, you can't just throw in "we think" and then expect me or anyone listening to think that by saying that, it's false. Here's how the truth is. It's not natural selection, because natural selection happens in the forest, and I get into arguments about that all the time. But it is selection. It's selective breeding. It's actually accelerated natural selection. But yes, we put in a pressure, or the pressure is applied, the weak die and the strong survive. That's as simple as it gets. But let's hear the other side. Unfortunately, it is much more complex than that with bees, and this process may not lead us to the end that we want. And we may not actually improve our bees. There are a few reasons why. Most of us don't live in isolated environments. Either we or someone else are bringing in new genetics. If I replace my losses with bees from outside my apiary, packages, or nucs, I'm completely negating the bottleneck effect of the losses of the year before, and I am replacing the susceptible population. Well, I do not live in an isolated environment. I live in the country with farms, plenty of houses. There's plenty of beekeepers around here. Luckily, I know a few of them, and I'm able to swap queens with them. Not really swap, give them queens, give them bees. Hopefully, my bees are mating with their bees. But I'm not in an isolated area. This thing where you have to live on an island to have any type of success is baloney. So she says, if I make splits and raise queens from my survivor stock, but I don't have an isolated mating yard, then those daughters are going to breed with whatever is out there, and I will have no idea if these new combinations can survive varroa. I'll have to let them die again to find out, getting me into a perpetual cycle of bee death. Well, yeah, you can't know who your bees mate with. The cool thing about honeybees is they mate with so many drones that there's a good chance she's not going to mate with an entire population of treated weak bees, especially if you live in a type of wooded area. And if you're not paying for bees, I'm probably going to say this 10 times, if you're doing the very easy process of networking, getting your name out there, setting bait hives, you don't have to have any money in this all at all. You don't have to be in the business of bees. You can just enjoy beekeeping, keep a couple colonies, and you can pretty much trash this whole podcast and turn it off. But not everyone is going to be buying fishing boats with their bees. So the next paragraph, you are not controlling how your bees manage varroa. Who? When did I say I was controlling that? Maybe your colony didn't have problems with varroa because it swarmed four times. Oh, that's great. So it constantly broke the brood cycle. This is one way to keep varroa populations from getting high, but now your neighbors have to pay thousands to get the colonies out from behind their siding, and your township is putting up an anti-beekeeping regulation. You want bees that manage varroa in a way that is good for your future beekeeping, not just staying alive by any means possible. No, I actually do want bees that stay alive by any means possible. And I lose plenty of swarms. I catch plenty of my own swarms, but I'm sure I lose plenty of swarms here. And I have not yet, in the 3 years that I live here, had anyone call me to get a local removal. I have houses clearly within flying distance of here, and no one has ever called me about that. And I also don't even suggest that if you live in the city or suburbs that you just let your bees swarm like crazy. Don't do that. No one says do that. But to say maybe your colony didn't have problems with varroa because it swarmed four times. Bees swarm. That's what they've been swarming for quite a long time. You can't, there's plenty of people who constantly do splits, constantly break the brood cycle. They're still treating and they lose their bees. So this idea that constantly breaking the brood cycle saves your bees is not true. I can point you to 100 people who broke the brood cycle a dozen times and their bees are dead. So that doesn't fly. Going on. If you only select for a single trait, you lose a lot of other good things. Thank goodness, I agree with that. If you only select for a single trait, you lose a lot of other good things. Right. So if you only select for, say, the mite count or whether they chew a leg or something or they bite an arm, whatever, and you're only selecting for that, you could miss a dozen things. The cool thing about selecting for survival is not one trait. A lot of things have to come together for a colony to survive. So I'm not selecting for one trait. But we agree on that. So let's go on. Let's say you live in an isolated forest and don't bring in any new genetics to your area and you breed only off your survivors and control their mating. There is a chance that you can get bees that are highly hygienic and can handle varroa. But what if they're jerks and are so highly defensive that you can't work with them or are susceptible to chalk brood? It's really hard to breed other good traits back in once they are lost. Wow, I don't even. This article just makes it so. Makes beekeeping seem so like I don't even want to do it anymore. I might just quit. Bees, but what if they're jerks and are so highly defensive? I've never even had that. I've had a couple warm colonies. But if that's your main concern that you're breeding for survival and a couple are going to be jerks and you just can't work with them or they're susceptible to chalk brood, I've never even seen that. Not saying it doesn't happen. I've never seen it. Oh, God. You can kill colonies that you actually want by putting them under too much pressure. Okay. Natural selection results in a balance between parasites and their host. If a parasite is so bad that it kills all the hosts, then the parasite dies too. In a parasite-host balance, the parasites don't kill as much, and the hosts are able to tolerate some level of parasitism. In the long view, we're looking for bees that can live at this balance. We may have some great bees in our yards that can live with some varroa and would thrive once we reach a balance with this pest. We would lose those hives, though, if we let 12 hives crash around. Sorry, it's a pet peeve. I can't stand when someone interchanges the word hive with a colony. Every time I see the word hive, I think of a square box with a lid and a bottom. but I digest. I'm gonna move, try to move past that. But here it goes again. We would lose those hives, though, if we let 12 hives crash around them. Well, a little higher up on this page, someone didn't lose a hive that had 19 colonies crash around them. So which one is it? Let's go on. The disease pressure may be too high for them to handle, and we would lose the very bees that we want to keep. No, I would say it's unfortunate that whoever the imaginary person is that lost 95%, you know, the actual treatment-free beekeeper who had a grasp on what they were doing, got the correct bees, kept them in the correct way, and somehow lost 95%. I would say that last colony, that last 5%, would be my, I would base my whole yard the next season off of it. I still wouldn't buy any bees, but that just seems too difficult. Too difficult for some beekeepers to grasp that. Here we go. I don't live in a completely isolated area, and since I use splits as a main part of my management, I am constantly creating new genetic combinations. Colonies that are going to have different behaviors and different abilities to handle disease. I also wanted to sell queens to beekeepers and have high quality queens for myself. So I knew I needed So I knew I needed to have gentle, productive colonies as well. Just leaving the bees alone wouldn't likely give me the strong northern stock I was looking for. So what I would say, the author says, I don't live in a completely isolated area. I watched a little YouTube. I would say the area where I see the author messing with some bees is quite a bit more isolated than where I live. Maybe they weren't the home yards. I don't know. But I don't live in an isolated area either. And I'm doing pretty well. So in big, bold letters, it says, so now I feel bad for letting my bees die and for putting other bees at risk. I'm broke, and I still don't have the bees that I want. But I still want to find good bees, and I don't want to just put chemicals in my hives all the time. What's a beekeeper to do? I don't know how you go broke with bees. I really don't know. If you get free bees, they're making you free honey, free wax. You're just buying boxes and frames. I mean, I'm not going broke. I don't know who these people are. They must have a lot of overhead in their commercial business, whatever it is. And that's a choice if you want to go into the bee business. And that's a choice and a risk that you take that I have not taken. I still keep my regular job. God, let's go on. After that spring, I reevaluated my goals as a beekeeper. I still didn't want to be on a cycle of treating all the time, and I still wanted to be working towards better bees. However, I also needed a way that my bees stayed healthy. I thought about why we navigate towards having unmanaged colonies in the first place, because it allows us to find out which bees can handle varroa and other diseases without treatment. What if we had a way of finding those bees without letting the rest of them die? Well, we do have that way, and I've been using it in the last few years, and I've been able to find colonies that don't need treatment, keep my losses down, and work towards having better bees, all the while taking good care of my girls. Oh man, that paragraph was sounding so good until that point. I mean, not correct, but it sounded good. Okay. Here is my new system for identifying treatment-free colonies while keeping healthy bees. You'll need the following: some honeybee colonies, a good system for taking notes, a method for monitoring mites, a source for good queens. Briefly, you will identify those colonies that aren't doing a good job of managing varroa mites and other diseases. You will first get them back to health. I underline that part because we all know what that means. You will first get them back to health. treat your bees. That's what's going on there. Knock the mites down, do whatever. This is a case of a non-treatment free beekeeper. Again, just the way Randy Oliver does, explaining, treatment-splaining to people how to be a treatment-free beekeeper. Okay, let me reread that just so it makes sense. Briefly, you will identify those colonies that aren't doing a good job of managing varroa mites and other diseases. You will first get them back to health and then requeen them from a better colony. The big thing to remember is that the properties of the colony are a product of the genetics, and the genetics of the colony are dependent on the queen. If you don't like a colony, you don't have to kill a bunch of innocent workers. You need to switch the genetics. Just replace the queen. There is never a need to let a colony crash and die. I would say there is a need to let a colony prove whether it can survive or not. To keep saying that me or anyone else is just purposely looking at a colony and going, yeah, I'm gonna know that they're gonna die and let them die. It's silly. It's really silly. If I have a colony that otherwise has the honey, has the population, but I see some bees crawling in the grass with mites, that's going to be where a treater jumps in and tries to save the day. I look at it as I want to see what they have. And dozens of times those colonies have survived and been split four ways in the spring. So this idea that we keep purposely killing bees is silly. It's disingenuous. And I don't like it very much. Okay, so number one. Start with some honeybees, okay? Two, start monitoring for varroa using a sugar roll or alcohol wash. Oh, goodness. Like, right off the bat, I lose all interest in this. Because this is going to become, instead of just an enjoyable pastime hobby, it's just going to become a constant science project. But let's continue. For instructions on how to do a sugar roll for monitoring, visit whatever website. Monitor each colony at least once a month. Oh, every month? It doesn't take long after you get the hang of it. You will soon find what colonies are keeping the varroa population stable and what colonies can't control varroa on their own. I have to say again, it's not all about varroa all the time. Bees can also die from other things. They can be unfit for other reasons, and also the varroa levels can be high or low for other reasons. You can't go by just the count that just happens to be at whatever number at the time that you're doing it. But let's try to go on. Number three, take good notes. Make sure you record swarms and supersedures and any activities that you do, like splits or drone brood removal. So, right there, drone brood removal. There's another thing that people do to try to lower mites. So, I guess what she's saying is if you're removing drone brood as a treatment, you're still going to go by the mite counts in that colony? That doesn't make sense. This will give you more information on why mite counts are low. Think about what characteristics are important to you. Varroa, gentleness, honey production, etc. And find a way to record that for each colony. For example, use a 1 to 5 gentleness scale and record what they act like each time you enter the colony. Write down how much honey you take off each colony, how they act on the frames, or if you just don't like the cut of their jib. So basically, she's going by, she's stating the opposite of something she said earlier, which was when you select for one thing. If you only select for one thing, and that's difficult, imagine if you're now selecting for approximately four or five things. It becomes many times harder to select for other things along with Varroamite counts, which are pointless. Here we go. If you just care about survival, then just keep a column for Varroa counts. Or in my case, I just care about survival, so I just keep and split bees that survive without treatments. That's how easy that is. For free. All my bees are free. Number four, once you find a colony that has a disease, including high mites, treat that colony and then requeen with a good queen. With a good queen. For a summary of naturally derived treatment options for Varroa, see pollinators dot whatever. So let's read number four again. Once you find a colony that has a disease, including high mites, treat that colony and then requeen with a good queen. Oh, God. This is how you become treatment-free, people. Treat that colony and then requeen with a good queen. But I ask, where do you get these good queens from? Let's read further. Keep watching your colonies to make sure that Varroa stays low and you don't see disease. Make sure you have notes that indicate which colonies never needed treatment and stayed healthy. Those are the ones you want to make queens from. Monitor, treat bees if there is a problem. Requeen the colony with queens from your best hives that don't need treatment. All your bees stay healthy and you don't lose colonies to preventable illness. Now that sounds great in theory. So I'm just going to say it, I don't know how you find out who your best queens are in the middle of the season, just by if you're just going by their Varroa counts. I mean, to me, my best ones are the ones that have that are now three winters, triple winterized, never been treated, never had a brood break, never been made healthy, and they're still the same ones I had. So those are the ones, yeah, that I would make queens off of, but I would only use those to requeen colonies that I just found in a random, obviously non-feral beekeeping area. And only if I was able to. I mean, I'm not going to stress about it. If I find that I can requeen them with my very best favorite queens, I'll do that. But it's not going to be based on, I'm not going to pinch a daughter of that queen just because her mite counts are high or whatever, her colony's mite counts are high, because I'm trying to keep the selection going, line breed, selectively breed, and it's not really breeding, it's just keeping them all one area so they interbreed with each other. But let's go on. Here are some examples of what it looks like in practice. Oh, I love this. Bill has five colonies in spring. He inspects every colony every 2 to 3 weeks to make sure they are queen right, have enough space, food, and are free from disease. Most times that he inspects, he does a sugar roll for mites. Less in the spring, more in the summer when the risk is higher. In May, colonies 1 to 4 look great, but colony 5 has chalk brood. He removes the queen from colony 5. Puts her in a nuc as a spare emergency. He orders a hygienic queen from a local breeder to put in colony 5. That also sounds good. Orders a hygienic queen from a local breeder to put in colony 5. I don't know. There's plenty of people around here that will say they have hygienic this and that or VHS that. Ask them if they treat. Yes, they do. So hygienic, be as hygienic as you want. If call your lines, pole lines or buckfast, whatever you want to call them, if you're treating them, it totally negates any of the silly claims of how great they are with mites. So let's go back to Bill and his five colonies. Chalk brood clears up. Throughout the spring, he continues to monitor, but hardly sees any mites in his sugar rolls. In June, he sees a few mites in some samples, but Hive One never has any. He records all these counts in his notes. By July, Bill is starting to see more mites while monitoring, but always below a threshold of 3 mites to 100 bees. In late July, colonies 2 or 4 are above the threshold. He treats them. He treats colonies 2 through 4. Once the treatment is finished, Bill orders 3 queens for fall requeening of colonies 2 through 4. The rest of the season, he keeps monitoring, and he doesn't get above the threshold again and doesn't see any other signs of disease. So that he looks like he ordered 3 queens from this local schmokel hygienic breeder who treats. So you're basically just providing a little brood break, I guess. But we go on to say, Bill ensures that everyone has enough food and bees and buttons them up for winter. In spring, Bill had 5 out of 5 colonies live. So let's just stop there. I follow a lot of, beekeepers. 5 out of 5. I mean, I've had 100% survival. It's not unbelievable, but this is just a really, perfect scenario. It's so obvious. It's ridiculous. Bill couldn't have lost 1 colony. Come on. I mean, he bought all his bees. He bought extra queens. He has a lot of money in this. Don't you just wish that you would always have 100% survival? They didn't survive. They were propped up. But yeah. Okay, we're going to compare this to beekeeper B, who we'll get to. Bill had 5 out of 5 colonies live. Actually, live is good. Call it live. Don't call it survive. He wants to start to raise his own queens, and looking through his notes, sees that Hive 1 didn't need any treatment. Hive 1. And stayed healthy. He'll see how they do this year and raise queens off of them to replace any queens from colonies that need them. Bill buys some queens from the same local breeder in the spring, using them to sell nukes from his colonies because he doesn't want to expand the apiary. He uses the money to take his favorite daughter fishing. Aww. So this, whoever Bill's local breeder is making a killing off of him. He's buying a bunch of these queens and selling all these nukes because he doesn't want to expand the apiary. I know a lot of treating beekeepers who are struggling just to maintain whatever numbers they feel like they need to have. But looks like Bill did really good with his treatment regimen. But let's compare that ideal scenario to beekeeper B. I don't know what B stands for, but maybe Bruce, I don't know. Beekeeper B has 5 colonies in the spring. He inspects them occasionally, but mostly just leaves them alone. Colony 5 has chalk brood, but he doesn't do anything about it. He doesn't monitor, but notes that colonies 1 through 4 are booming, and colony 5 seems slower. He closes them up for winter at the end of the season. His bees in colonies 2 through 4 succumb to varroa-associated viruses, and colony 5 had too small of a cluster. In spring, beekeeper B has only 1 colony left, and I underline this part, and he buys 3 more packages to replace his losses. I don't know who this beekeeper B is, but he sounds like a clown. Continuing, he does this a few more years and then quits beekeeping because it's too expensive and he would rather spend the money on more fishing gear. So that's your comparison. That's, I guess, the second example. Beekeeper B is what the author calls a treatment-free beekeeper, which I clearly explained is not. They may want to call themselves a person who doesn't treat their bees, But as I said, you're starting with bees that are from the south, dependent on treatments, and you just bring them up here and let them die. It's kind of like taking some domestic, whatever, goats and just letting them loose to get eaten. It's silly. I don't suggest that. No one who actually puts the effort into collecting bees for free and selecting from them would suggest that you buy packages or nukes, whether someone local has them or not. I think a more realistic scenario, and I'll even make it kind of bad just so that, make it more realistic. Someone listens to the advice of someone who catches swarms, networks like crazy, makes a little business card, pokes it around on all the gas stations and shops, makes a little lame website like mine, ilovebees.buzz, gets a ton of calls in the spring. Let's just be really conservative, and gets 10 swarm calls. Doesn't really get into cutouts yet because that's something I suggest you learn about that, but before you do it, but goes and gets 10 swarms, boxes them up, and just does beekeeping with them. Make sure they have the right amount of space, make sure the thing you put them in is sound, doesn't stress about mites. Feeds them if it's necessary. If your area is, they might need a little boost, but they might not. Some of my yards don't ever need any feeding. Then beekeeper B, insulates the lid a little bit, tips her hive forward, and lets them go for the winter. And let's just say 50% of them die. So instead of 10, 10 is a very low number. I'll have 10 by the end of April. But this one, someone just starting out. 10 colonies, they're left with 5. 5 were junk. Now this beekeeper who has no money invested in his bees knows that the ones that he has left at least can survive the local conditions, survived whatever was thrown at them for that season. Has a bunch of drawn comb, probably has, when bees die from varroa, they usually leave a ton of honey behind. Five colonies, who knows how much honey beekeeper B could have, but it's probably a significant amount. Has wax, can do whatever with everything, and then he can, with one single split in the spring, five really strong splits, he's right back at 10 again. And that's before he even gets his first swarm call for the season, which is going to be even more the second season because now more connections are made. And it just kind of snowballed for me. But that's more realistic. I'm not losing 50% anymore because I've been selecting. But let's just say he loses 8 of the 10. So what? Those two survived what killed 8 others right there in the same vicinity. Those two can be split into, as the author says, possibly 3 strong nukes, or 4 more than each. So you're looking at 6. Catch a couple swarms, fill them boxes up. It's that easy, and it's much funner that way. You're not constantly monitoring. You're not hurting anybody. Your bee, unless your bees are all dead. Yeah, that happens. I mean, I've never had it happen. But this person is actually selecting. This person is not hurting the surrounding bees because he's not propping up weak genetics to flood the area anymore. Maybe the first year if he caught some crappy bees off of some southern nukes or something, the damage is minimal. But that's more realistic. So let's finish this up. We all want to move to a place where we don't have to treat our bees, but we want to make sure it's because our bees don't need treatment, not because we are withholding care. Because we have the tools of varroa monitoring and requeening, we don't have a reason to let a colony die while we work towards better stock. Do right by your bees this year by responsibly moving towards treatment-free. To happy beekeepers and healthier bees. Megan Milbrath, PhD. So, I mean, to wrap it up, again, as I said, this is a non-treatment-free beekeeper. Treatment explaining how to be a treatment-free beekeeper using all kinds of terms misleadingly and setting up these really lame scenarios of how things work between two camps of beekeepers. So let me know what you hear about this, what you think about this. I realized at the beginning that I said Brother Abby when I meant Brother Adam while I was editing. So yeah, I said that. That was dumb. But all right. Take care. See you at the next Mike Bomb Beekeeping Podcast.